We are the space robots. We are here to protect you. Back, Cooey, us. Back, Cooey, us. Back, Cooey, us.
All right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Pusher Robot.
And this is the Shover Robot.
And we're here to protect you from the terrible secret of space.
Oh, yes. The terrible secret of space. Well, space has a very exciting secret this past week. If anyone's been, you know, not living in a cave.
Yeah, living under a rock.
Living under a rock in the bottom of the ocean. Because I think even if you were just in a cave, you'd probably hear about this. Pluto. Oh, my gosh. We have pictures of Pluto. And why is that a big deal?
Well, it's kind of a big deal because we have never been able to really see it all that well before because darn thing is tiny and far away.
Far, far away. A long time ago. Well, not really. Well, a long time ago, far, far away, New Horizons was launched in respect to Pluto, but now it's there. It's there and taking pictures, and we got all sorts of exciting data. But we're going to get into that a little bit later.
Yeah, I think first what we should talk about here is exactly why we even care about Pluto,
right?
Other than that whole, like, dwarf planet debate that was going on several years ago. Like, why do we even care about Pluto?
Well, why don't we care about Pluto?
Well,
indeed.
You know, more planetary bodies. So a little history before we start off. In 1906, Percival Lowell was talking and learning about the nature of the orbits of Uranus and Neptune. And originally, Uranus was known to have a kind of weird orbit. And they did their orbital mechanics that they could in the 19th century and said, okay, there must be this planet here. So they pointed a telescope at it and found Neptune. And they said, okay, cool. That solves the whole Uranus problem. And then later, Percival Lowell's going back and going, okay, even with Neptune, Uranus's orbit doesn't make any sense. There's got to be something else, a planet X, which we all know that's where Marvin the Martian comes from.
It doesn't come from Mars?
What's wrong with the universe?
Makes no sense.
So there was a planet X that was out on the far reaches of our solar system that was distorting the orbits of Uranus and Neptune. And so the Lowell Observatory, like Percival Lowell died after making the Lowell Observatory. And later in 1929, Clyde Tombaugh, a Kansan farmer, was hired on. He had a love of drawing astronomical phenomena and providing concept art for planetary bodies. So he was hired on to go run their observatory and blink comparator, where basically you take two pictures of the same sector of the night sky two nights, maybe a couple days apart, and then you take a look and you see what's moved between that time, and you catalog all of those movements and try to figure out which ones are like stars moving or comets or planets. And the photos are grainy as heck, and I have no idea how they even did that, but you know, that's kind of how it was back then. So
it's kind of like, you know, you got two pictures side by side. It's like with the camera, with video. You just got one frame and another frame, and you swap between the two of them as fast as you can, and you kind of produce a little bit of movement. Or, yeah. you know, the old, when I grew up, my grandpa taught me the effects of, you know, moving frames. You know, you got the little pack, you get a sticky notes, and you drew a different dot on the bottom of it, and as you flip through it, the darn thing moved across the bottom. And that's kind of similar to how the blink comparator works, as far as shifting back and forth between each frame.
Yeah, we discovered Pluto via flipbook is basically what we're getting at. So in February 18th of 1930, they had Clyde Tombaugh had a pretty good idea that he had found the planet that they were looking for. And after they took a couple more pictures and did the math, they confirmed it on March 13th of 1930 when they telegraphed their findings to the Harvard College Observatory for official verification and cataloging. So, yeah, we had a ninth planet. Woo! Oh,
we had a ninth planet, but that would not last forever. The cool thing though is that you know, after we had found it, we actually went back and looked at some of the older observations that we had of the night sky and where Pluto was, and they're like, oh look, there it is, like we found it. You know how it's, you know, a little bit easier to find Waldo after you've already found him the first time? They went back and they found Waldo.
Yeah,
I mean Pluto.
Pluto. They should have named it.
Maybe
Waldo.
They should have named it Waldo. The Where's Pluto? Where's Waldo? Oh gosh.
Yeah. Fun fact. Pluto actually, the name Pluto actually came from a schoolgirl. After they, like, when an observatory finds a planet, they get the opportunity to name it. The observatory has that right, and so people were sending in a lot of recommendations. And an 11-year-old schoolgirl in England named Venetia Burney came up with the name Pluto because she was just super stoked about classical mythology. And Pluto is a god of the underworld, and I believe Roman, if I'm not mistaken. Roman?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Hades would be the Greek.
Okay. See, Hercules gets me screwed up all the time. Disney movies. So, Venetia Burney suggested the name, and it eventually came down to three finalists, and Pluto, which were voted on between the members of the observatory staff, and Pluto received roughly all the votes, because Pluto is kind of a cool name. So that's what got it its name, and then it went on to name a whole bunch of other stuff.
It did indeed. And just to give you a little tidbit of information about how long ago this was, yeah, Venetia Burney, she died in 2009.
Yeah,
she was 90 years old. So I mean, Pluto is still relatively new as far as astronomical bodies go. But I mean, a long time ago this was.
Yeah, we've known about it for a while.
We've known about it for a while. It had a good long run as a planet. But yeah, we've named a couple of things after Pluto, including some of my favorite stuff, plutonium.
Yeah.
Yes.
It blew my mind. Seriously, like, I don't know if I'm just dumb, but I have been looking at, you know, uranium, plutonium, and neptunium all my adult life through college and stuff. And just for the research for this particular podcast, it was like, oh, yeah, and that, of course, got plutonium, its chemical name, just like uranium and neptunium before it. I'm like, what is this?
So what came first, Pluto or plutonium? No, you won't find plutonium on Pluto.
That's too bad.
Oh, dang it. That's why we thought it was named Pluto. No.
We can
Doesn't
only hope.
That would be incredible. That would be a terrible secret of space. I'll tell you what.
Yep, it's actually a giant bomb. And then, of course, we got Pluto the dog. You know, Mickey's best pal and astronomical phenomena. Just, you know, it's kind of cool. So that's a brief history of Pluto. And, of course, why we care is because anything that helps us establish an understanding of our solar system at large is valuable knowledge for the human race as we make our way and push into space. And, of course, it almost accounts for the orbital irregularities of Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto itself. Not to say that it completely accounts for everything, but science is still trying to build an understanding of the Kuiper Belt and stuff outside. Mm-hmm. So that'll wait until we have better telescopes or until New Horizons reaches it.
Absolutely. It's on its way there. It's speeding right along, going off into the black there. It ain't coming back, that's for sure.
Yep. Spoiler alert, you know. So one thing that is unique about Pluto, of course, is the fact that it's the only, like, classical, what we consider a planetary body, even though it's an icy dwarf planet at this point, but it's basically like a binary planet that it's got its biggest moon, which I'm going to call Charon.
And I'm going to call Charon, just to be different.
Yeah, so good luck keeping up with that through the rest of this podcast. But Charon was discovered in quite a bit later, in July of 1978, by James Christie. And the way that they found that is they were taking some, at that time, high-resolution images. It, once again, to me, looks like giant, splotchy...
It's an inkblot,
like,
test.
Yeah, like...
Let's be honest.
Rorschach tests for planets. And they noticed that it was periodically bulging, that Pluto was periodically bulging, and James Christie determined that that was because of an additional body that was moving around it, which at that time was thought to just be a type of moon, kind of like our moon orbits our planet. Not as it ended up being, where Charon and Pluto kind of orbit each other in a tidally locked formation because the Bay Center, I think is what it's called, is the point of center of mass of the system exists outside of Pluto between it and Charon, so they kind of rotate around that and by that way each other. So
absolutely,
we
all planets do that too. I mean, you know, little known fact, or maybe not little known, but uncommonly known perhaps. The Earth and the Sun, we do the exact same thing. Everything has a little wobble. Like, the, for instance, the Earth and the Moon, we don't orbit, the Moon doesn't orbit the Earth. The Earth and the Moon orbit the common center of mass between the Earth and the Moon, which is ends up being a little bit offset from what the center of the Earth is. And the Sun does the exact same thing with the Earth and all the other planets, which is makes it a kind of complex and fascinating system. But hey, celestial mechanics is a beautiful and mysterious thing.
Indeed it is. So that was when Charon was posited, and it just so happened that a few years later in 1985, Charon and Pluto entered a period where its orbital or axis of orbit is planar when viewed from Earth. So Charon moves in front of Pluto all the time instead of moving kind of off to the side as if it was its orbit was at a tilt. And that allowed us to see the change in albedo between Pluto and Charon, and that's how we fully determined that there was indeed a large moon, because as we've seen from the new photos from New Horizon, Charon is definitely much, much darker than Pluto is. It has a much lower albedo.
Mm-hmm. It sure does, and that's due to its the differences in ices that it's got on its surface. We're looking at potentially water and ammonia ices on Charon. Charon, I gotta stick with the way I'm gonna supposed to say it. Dang it!
I'm winning.
You are. the water ice, and we've also got potential for cryo geysers, because nothing is cooler than geysers except a cryo geyser, both literally and phonetically. A cryo geyser, also kind of like the thing we've got up on Enceladus, although not as quite as cold as the one we might have on Charon. And Pluto, of course, we're going to have a little bit of a different mixture of ices, looking at methane, nitrogen predominantly, with a little bit of carbon monoxide mixed in just to keep things interesting. But we're still learning a heck of a lot of new stuff about that right now. This very second, data is pouring in, trickling in at least, from New Horizons and getting us more information on the compositions of these two planetoids.
Yeah, and it's really cool because at this point is when the theories abound, because all we can tell right now is that, surprisingly, both planetoids are pretty darn smooth, which is really weird for two planets. Because usually, in orbital mechanics, you have planets that are completely kind of dead, and they've got really dulled over mountains, and they've got really cratered surfaces, kind of like our moon. Because our moon is no longer geologically active, so it doesn't have a way to renew its surface. But it looks like, from the pictures, that Pluto and Charon are somehow renewing their surfaces, because normally they'd be completely pockmarked with asteroid impacts, and their mountains would be kind of flat, because they'd have worn over time, due to those same kind of asteroid impacts and whatever counts as weather on icy bodies. But that's not happening. And normally you'd be like, oh, well, the moon, you know, Charon revolving around Pluto is causing tidal forces kind of like it does here on the Earth. But Charon and Pluto are tidally locked, so there's no delta in forces between the two of them. They experience the same force on the same point on the surface all the time. So it's really weird, and that's really cool.
Yep, we don't have really a good idea what's going on. I'd like to think maybe it has something to do with the evaporation of those ices on the surfaces, creating somewhat of an erosion factor, renewing and, you know, taking ice out and putting it out back somewhere else. Kind of like what you have on Mars with its seasonal poles that are huge, enormous poles of carbon dioxide. And this, I would imagine, might happen something similar on Pluto and Charon. But you know what also interesting? You know, looking at the pictures, there's no ice on the poles or anything different. It, you know, it's kind of all the same. You know, we got various geological features and different colorations in the center on different sides of it, but there's not like a poles But I guess, I know that's to be considered because it's such a small body. You wouldn't have a whole lot of variation. But it's so different than what we were expecting. It's amazing, and it's pretty stinking cool at that.
Yeah, and I suppose I should explain why, although I seem to be winning on the Charon versus Charon debate.
You do.
Is the reason why we have this kind of argument going on between us is that in the naming scheme of Pluto and its several moons, the other ones are Styx, Nix, Hydra, and I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Kerberos?
Kerberos.
Kerberos. Thank you. They all are to do with the underworld in various mythologies, although I think they're predominantly Roman is the origin for all of these. And Charon is the ferryman in Roman mythology for the underworld. But yep. When James Christie discovered Charon, his wife, Charlene, he wanted to name his discovery after her, so he kind of grabbed the first part of her name, Char, and threw on something scientific like on, so he got Charon. And although the team at the observatory wasn't originally going to go for that, they kind of found out, coincidentally, that Charon was a figure in this underworld mythology, and so they got some credence to keep the name, and it kind of stuck. So sometimes you hear it pronounced Charon, which is how the Discoverer pronounced it and how the New Horizons team pronounces it, but if you're going with the classic mythology theme, it'd be pronounced Charon instead. So there you go. Yep. Fun fact.
You got your C's in Latin make a hard K sound, so
the more you know.
Cave canem, beware the dog.
Yep. So lastly, of course, what we want to talk about, like, the system is really cool. It's at the edge of the solar system, and up until now we have had no real idea of what was going on there other than the fact that there were at least two planetary bodies. So In the late 90s, there were some propositions to go out and send a mission to go past or to even land on and return with samples from Pluto, and that was struck down for several years due to problems in the planning stages, and because, oh my god, we're sending some kind of probe over 3 billion miles away in a journey that's going to take 3,000 or so days, 3,500 days to get there. So what are we even doing? And that eventually ended up as the New Horizons mission, which launched on January 19th, 2006, which is a time back when I was still in high school, and that is pretty cool.
Oh, it launched the 19th of January?
Yes.
Excellent. That is pretty cool because that's my anniversary. Not that year, but, you know, That's cool.
Now you have two things to celebrate.
I can celebrate New Horizons and I can celebrate my lovely wife. Yeah. Excellent.
So, basically, what were you saying?
Nothing. I'm good.
Okay. I hate interrupting you. I do it all the time. But, you know, shoving is better, so
pushing, anyway.
Yeah, whatever. So, one of the interesting things about the mission is that right before the mission started, the Hubble Space Telescope redirected itself to take a lot of, at that point, high-quality pictures of the Pluto-Charon system, because at that point, all we knew was Pluto and Charon. And right before that, we found a couple of the moons, and I think that it was Nix and Kerberos were the first two that were found, and on New Horizons' way, it discovered Hydra and Styx. I might have had those backwards, but the point is that we didn't even know that it had five moons. We thought it only had one until this mission started off. So that, of course, caused some mission complications because they found all these additional moons. They're like, oh my god, if they are crashing into each other, they're going to make some kind of dusty ring, and New Horizons is going to get there and die, and that would be awful.
That would be pretty awful. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it, too. I mean, you sent it off on its way, it's here it goes, and you just realize, oh, shoot, we're sending it to its grave. It's going to be turned into shrapnel, and that will be it for this project. That would be a pretty sad day.
There it goes. We've had, like, nine years of waiting, and, you know, millions and millions of dollars poured into this research and all of the mission control aspects here at home, and it hits a dustband and explodes. That would have been totally awful.
But it didn't happen.
No, we got lucky.
Thank goodness. We got some awesome information.
And in fact, New Horizons is still technically on its mission. Not only has it not yet sent back all of the data at this moment when this podcast is being recorded, it hasn't yet sent back all of the data that it got during encounter mode, which is the mode that it enters when it got close enough to Pluto, so it shuts down its communication with Earth so that it can focus all of its processing power on gathering as much atmospheric data. You know, I say atmospheric in loose quotes. Basically,
no, yeah, it does have an atmosphere, though. Yeah. I mean, there's considerable, more so than you would imagine, on an icy boon. It's on an icy little body, so just floating out there, which is fascinating because, you know, and I know this is a little bit of a tangent, but Pluto, smaller than the Earth's moon, has somewhat of an atmosphere. What the heck? Now this is, of course, because it's so far out there, it's so cold. You've got things that are going to be able to stick to it a little bit better, and they're not being blown off constantly by the solar wind and the heat from the sun. So yeah, that's got that going for it. But still, like, what? That's pretty stinking cool.
Yeah, it's impressive, all of the new information that we're getting about it. But it went into encounter mode, it captured all of this data, and didn't communicate with NASA. And then we had that really big moment. I think it was like 8:50 PST. 5:50 PST. It would be 8:50.
Was that Pluto standard time?
Yeah. Yeah, we wish. That'd be pretty cool. But they had that NASA live stream, and everybody's like sitting around in mission control going like, okay, is New Horizons going to report back in? Because the signal should be getting here. And then we got all the stuff, and everybody had these standing ovations, and I was like fist pumping all over the apartment. And it was pretty good. It was a good celebration. But
I was asleep.
Yeah. So now that we've got over that hurdle and we have all this data, it's got to be sent back. And Pluto or New Horizons has a worse connection than your old 56K modem. Currently, it's running at about 1K to 2K bits per second, which is stupid slow. So it takes something like 45 minutes to download each of these images, even with it being super packed and compressed with no metadata associated with it. It's just sending over raw image data, and it still takes 45 minutes per shot, and it's got a lot of stuff it still needs to send us.
Dang.
And
so essentially you're saying that this makes your, you know, our old internet with the all the noises and stuff, that is to what we have now as how fast this is moving compared to the 56K.
Yeah, seriously. And not to mention it's got a 4.5-hour lag time at the moment, and that, of course, is growing steadily as it moves farther and farther away from Earth.
Speed of light is just too
darn
slow. Yeah. Speed of light is too darn slow.
Yeah, it's always... We might end up doing a podcast episode about this a little bit later. Originally, this episode was going to be on inner space and interplanetary communications, but the Pluto stuff is just too darn cool to pass up, and I mean, you know, we'll probably only get this opportunity once in a podcast lifetime to cover something kind of this cool.
It's happening immediately right now.
But suffice it to say, getting data from spacecraft is difficult, because not only do we have a lot of spacecraft we're trying to get data from, a lot of different probes, and we only have so many big radar receivers on the planet that as they rotate through that section, we get a certain amount of times for it.
That's right. The Deep Space Network. Yeah. That sounds pretty cool, doesn't it?
Deep Space Internet. We'll eventually have it. It'll be cool. I like it. But we have this, we have only so much time to receive data for these various projects, and with that slow of a data transfer rate, it really limits what we can get back at one time. So there's going to be a long period for probably several months where we're still receiving data from that historic flyby on July 14th of this year.
That's a lot of data.
Yeah, seriously. But its mission will still continue. New Horizons was designed to carry on, and if the suits at NASA did their job correctly, which they always seem to, because, oh my god, they hit the tiniest target at 3 billion miles away, so I would never want to play darts with any of these guys. But it's still going to continue on and go into the Kuiper Belt, and should be passing by a couple of larger icy bodies that we're aware of, and gather some additional data on them, which will give us a better a better understanding of how the Kuiper Belt is formed and what kind of things it contains in it, because at this point we don't really know all that much, because it's, you know, a farther away asteroid belt that hangs around.
Yeah, way out there. And it's interesting too, because like you said, we're going out there to see if we go past some of the things that we know that are already out there, but we don't know all what's out there because of the stuff out there is so darn far away. The sunlight that it takes to get back is just, it's almost impossible to see. So we might end up, you know, it's possible that we'd run into something out there, literally just smack into it.
Yeah.
But we might get a really cool, close flyby of something that we weren't quite expecting. So shoot, science is awesome, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Who knows what we'll find out there. Beyond our solar system, or not beyond it, but, you know, at the outer limits of what we call and consider our solar system. You know, after that, you got the Oort cloud, but we really have not a whole lot of clue about what the heck's out there, except, you know, well, that's where comets are from, but, you know, we're still trying to figure that all out.
Yeah, we got barely nothing on that whole thing. Yeah, it also should probably be mentioned very briefly before we get along to finishing up here, that unlike the Star Wars representation of asteroid belts and things like the Kuiper Belt, it's really hard to hit something in those.
Mm-hmm.
The asteroids and small bodies that make them up are so far apart from each other.
Oh yeah, it's incredible the distances in between.
So I hate to break it to you, but C-3PO is kind of full of crap.
Sir, but the odds. Never tell me the odds, 3PO.
Yeah, you're wrong anyway. Damn robots. So, yeah, that is Pluto. And it's close buddy Sharon.
Karin.
Whatever.
Yes.
You know how much you've said Sharon this episode.
I know, it's I'm gonna be eating my words as I re-listen to this later.
Yep. So it's happening right now. We got a lot of cool things that we're learning. There's a lot of cool things that we are still going to learn, and we will probably end up doing a follow-up episode here in a couple months after they've had a chance over at NASA to process these images and process the false color images that are doing a little bit more on the spectroscopy. You know what I'm saying.
Struggle with that one.
Yep. Checking out checking out what kinds of elements and molecules are present on the surface just by the frequencies of light they bounce at. Spectroscopy. Jeez. Okay.
But English is not your thing.
No,
it's okay. We don't need to speak English today.
We don't need to speak English. But after they finish analyzing that, we're going to get...
The science is done.
Yeah, after the science is done and you make a neat gun, we're going to know a whole lot more about what's going on with Pluto, and hopefully it'll bring us to some additional amazing discoveries on what life is like on the outer rim of our solar system.
Absolutely, positively. And shoot, you know what? I think that's about it we've got for today.
Yep. So keep your eyes trained on New Horizons, because it's going to be pretty interesting.
Yep.
All right.
And always, I'm the shover robot.
And I'm the pusher robot.
And you have gone down the stairs. I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space.